Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it is Friday, March 1st, 2019. Hopefully some good basketball and good weather just around the corner. For us, a good week of policy proposals and a little bit of controversy when it comes to congressional matters. Here to discuss some of what was certainly a fluid week in North Carolina politics is Chris Cooper, department head and professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University, joining us on the phone line from the mountains. Chris, how are you?
It's great. Great to be here, and always a good day to be in the mountains.
You're in Cullowhee right now?
I am in Cullowhee. I'm staring at some rain, which for people who know Cullowhee, that should not be a surprise.
There was Mark Meadows. There was an election schedule that came for the special election in the 3rd District. There was a proposal on cell phones, and there was much more. We're going to try to get to some of it here, but let's start, as we occasionally do, with your story of the week. What was it in the political sphere?
You know, I mean, I think this Mark Meadows story, in a lot of ways, was the story of the week. Obviously, you know, it had to center around the Cohen testimony. Everybody's paying attention to that. And then the local angle where all of a sudden Mark Meadows, you know, fourth-term member of Congress from Western North Carolina, becomes the guy that's being debated on the pages of national and international press.
All right. Multiple days of this dramatic, controversial, and I've got three question marks in my notes here in front of me next to the word trustworthy. I don't even know how to articulate that with my voice, because I think, you know, Michael Cohen is about as trustworthy as you could throw the studio equipment that I'm looking at here. But there was all this testimony on Capitol Hill pertaining to Trump and Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen. He was in the hot seat. But perhaps, as you just alluded to, the most acrimonious exchange came between Rashida Tlaib, the first-term congresswoman from Detroit, and North Carolina's own Mark Meadows. Set this up a little bit for us. Yeah. As it pertains to this this conversation, this debate about race.
Yeah, so just brief little bit of backstory for those who don't think North Carolina politics all the time. So Mark Meadows, fourth-term member of Congress, took over a seat that was held by Heath Shuler before and then was redistricted, and so Meadows is the first holder of this seat since it was redistricted. So Meadows kind of quickly made a name for himself in Washington, right? He's from this district that not a lot of folks know about, but he's on, you know, does the rounds on Meet the Press, and he is on sort of every major media outlet. And so he's chair of the Freedom Caucus, been extremely conservative since he's been in office. And he has been on the side of Trump recently, which we can certainly talk about how recent that is. And so he's trying to argue for Trump. He's trying to argue against Cohen and really hitting on Cohen's point that Trump is a racist, which was Cohen's exact words. And so Meadows says, hey, look, sitting behind me is an African-American member of Trump's staff, and this shows that Trump is, in fact, not a racist. And then Tlaib comes out and says, that by saying that, you, my friend, are a racist. And Mark Meadows turns fairly red-faced and goes at her. They go back and forth for a little while. And then Elijah Cummings, interestingly, African-American member of Congress, jumps in and says, look, I want to see if we can go ahead and put a stop to this now. Mark Meadows is my best friend on this committee. Can you guys work this out? And supposedly they have now worked it out.
Which, for the record, I had no idea that Cummings and Meadows were good friends. Did you know that?
You know, I'm not invited to the same cocktail party, but if I do recall, when there was some discussion of Meadows maybe being chief of staff for Trump,
right,
Cummings did actually come out and say, hey, look, I got to tell you, I like Mark Meadows. I think he's a good choice.
All right, couple things to unpack here. One, I guess I just want to clarify. I watched the clip. My consumption of this hearing was limited for several reasons this week. One of which was I was covering things at the legislature. The other of which I only had so much patience. I wasn't going to sit through 6 or 7 hours of testimony listening or viewing. But Tlaib didn't exactly say you're racist, Mark Meadows. I mean, to me, it was a pretty clear shot across the bow. She said, if you insinuate such a thing, you yourself are racist. But she didn't name him by name, but he took it that way, as I would have. And then there was this this intense back and forth between the two of them. I believe that I think the conclusion here is that they hugged on the House floor a day or two later. Is that
correct as I understand it, and that is exactly my read too. She didn't say you, Mark Meadows, are racist. She simply said what you have said, what you are doing,
right,
is racist.
Right.
And then this, of course, is brought up, as you can imagine, old footage of Mark Meadows, right? So there's footage from June of 2012 when he ran for office the first time from the Blue Ridge Tea Party, where he said if Republicans are successful in the fall, we will send him, meaning Obama, back to Kenya or wherever that is.
So Mark Meadows, as you mentioned, now, and he's a four-term congressman, and he was very much part of this right-wing faction. I mean, he co-founded, he's one of the leaders of the Freedom Caucus, mm-hmm. was perhaps he singularly the biggest thorn in John Boehner's side. Mark Meadows gets as much credit as anybody for upending the speakership of John Boehner. And Mark Meadows was considered, as you mentioned, for chief of staff a couple of months ago, obviously a position that went to Mick Mulvaney. Just to remind listeners and also bring this into the conversation, there's also a little bit of a controversy that emerged pertaining to his educational acumen and whether or not he or someone around him fudged the qualifications in terms of his degree. Remind us of that.
Yeah. So Mark Meadows is from Florida, a fact that he doesn't like to bring up that often, but he is from Florida. And so he went to the university, went to Florida State for a little while, then he went to the University of South Florida for a little while. And so somewhere along the line, attended the University of South Florida, was changed on his official biography to graduated from the University of South Florida. And so the Tampa Bay newspaper picked that up. Some local folks here in Western North Carolina picked that up. And so this controversy has erupted. And the question is, did Meadows do this? Did a staff member do this? Did Meadows mean to do this? Or was this just a mistake by an intern?
And what's your read on that situation?
Yeah, my read on that is I find it very hard to believe that Mark Meadows directed anyone to change his bio. I think my guess is a staff member took attended as graduated. I certainly spent a lot of time, maybe too much time, going through state legislators usually encoding their education for various research projects. And a lot of times members of Congress and state legislators will say attended thus and such a school. And it's always hard to know, did they actually graduate from that place? So my guess is this was a mistake that just got repeated over and over and over again. And as I've said to some folks, I think the reminding people that he is from Florida might actually be a bigger knock on him in Western North Carolina than him not having a college degree.
Okay, so candidly, you probably keep a much closer watch on Meadows than I do. From my standpoint, he is less relevant than he was when his party was in the majority. And I also think that he's an interesting person to keep an eye on as we look ahead to a 2020 U.S. Senate campaign, really only if Tom Tillis weren't to run. I don't expect Meadows to challenge him in a primary, but also an open, as we expect, an open U.S. Senate seat in 2022 when Richard Burr is not expected to run for re-election and effectively retire. So getting into the speculation game here, as you look at Mark Meadows and kind of a different role today than it was a year ago, where do you think he goes from here?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question I think a lot of us are trying to figure out. I mean, unless the districts change, it looks like Meadows is going to hold on to the seat for a long time, right? So he keeps running against some Democratic challengers who, frankly, don't perform that well electorally in this district, and we would expect that to continue, right? So he's got kind of a perfect seat to hold on to take shots whenever he wants to. You know, he was considered for chief of staff, and from everything I read and hear, he really was interested in that position. So I don't think that was ginned up. I think that's real. I think what that tells me is he may not be satisfied to be in Congress forever. And so, yeah, I think a 2022 Senate seat is a very reasonable goal for Mark Meadows. He's got this very interesting profile, right? He is, I like to say, he's personally civil but politically extreme. Right, so if you look at his policy positions, you say, man, this guy is kind of, you know, to the extreme of right of the Republican Party, yet he gets along personally with Democrats. And yesterday, or 2 days ago, accepted, he's actually a fairly civil person.
Chris Cooper joining us from Western Carolina. He is a professor at Western Carolina University. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Cooper, that's with a C, WCU. We're going to move from Meadows to the congressional delegation of North Carolina. Meadows, coincidentally, serves the 11th district. North Carolina has 13 U.S. House seats, but only 11 members of Congress right now. Two of the three vacancies in the country due to the passing of Walter Jones last month, and also the calling of a new election in the 9th because of election fraud. And let me just stop here, and I guess I'm going to ask you an editorial question, even though you're a professor. I was having a conversation with some colleagues before you and I got going today. You're unaware of what I'm about to ask you here. Pertaining to the word alleged, and I had a colleague say to me, hey, can we use, is it still election, alleged election fraud, or at this point, do we know that there's been election fraud? And from my vantage point, you have to say Leslie McRae Dallas is alleged to have committed election fraud, because of course that hasn't been adjudicated and he isn't convicted. But to me, I feel pretty comfortable saying we had election fraud at this point. Yeah, how do you, and you're not a reporter, but how do you look at that?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question, and I look at it the same way, right? I mean, we can't say with 100% certainty who did it, but I think we can say with 100% certainty that it occurred. And I also like that when you're describing this, you're talking about election fraud, not voter fraud. So I thought, you know, a political science colleague of mine, Mike Bitzer, that a lot of folks know, I thought had a really nice piece in the Washington Post arguing that, hey, we need to not talk so much about voter fraud, but talk about election fraud. And it's election fraud that happened here, not voter fraud.
Key difference being voter fraud would be if an individual tries to vote twice or does
right.
something that's one-off. But election fraud is more systematic. I mean, you have an operation, as we heard detailed in an evidentiary hearing last week, State Board of Elections, about what was going on in Bladen County. So let's get into, I guess, first the 9th. There were five indictments that came down this week. Those would be the people who are alleged to have conspired and been involved in this effort to fraud the 9th congressional election led by Leslie McRae Dallas. Again, I'm just going to start with a speculative question. It seems to me as though there may very well be more indictments coming on this front. Do you think that – do you have a read on that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think there are going to be more indictments coming down. I mean, this is large scale election fraud, and so I find it very hard to believe that it would be contained to even the single digits, right? I mean, to pull off something of this scale and this magnitude is going to probably involve dozens of folks. So yes, I would imagine that we're going to see more coming out of this story. And more folks indicted.
Sure. Is this reminiscent, certainly not that I'm aware of, anything in North Carolina in recent decades, if ever, is this scale of election fraud reminiscent of anything that you're aware of elsewhere in the United States?
Not documented, right? I mean, we hear these stories about, you know, kind of early 1900s and this kind of election fraud happening. I think it's important to remember we didn't always have this Australian ballot. And by Australian ballot, what I mean is the notion of a secret ballot. We haven't always had that in the United States. And so election fraud would have looked very, very different before we went to a secret ballot in the United States. So certainly we've probably seen things like this, but not in the last half century at the very least.
So Mark Harris, who won by 905 votes or so it appeared back in early November, the election, just as a reminder, was never certified, and it was unclear, I guess, officially until this week whether or not he was going to run again. I think those of us who have been following this thought there was no chance he was going to run again. He cited health issues as the reason why he's not going to run, but of course there might be much ahead for Mark Harris in this whole saga. Looking at the Democrat, Dan McCready, he has continued to raise money throughout this controversy, throughout, you know, all of the speculation and the media reports that have transpired in recent months. McCready is back in the race. He's got a war chest of money. It seems as though there's also an element of sympathy with him because, you know, I think some people are going to look at McCready and say, hey, should he have won? Was this his victory back in November and it was taken away? I think he's a sympathetic candidate on some degree. Mm-hmm. So this is, it seems to me, his to lose, even if it is a Republican-leaning district. Mm-hmm. The Republican field is taking shape here, and I think we'll have a better sense of it in the next couple of weeks. We don't have a schedule yet for the 9th congressional race. My question to you, if you're a Republican candidate, why would you get into the 9th right now?
You know, I think you'd get into the 9th right now because you think it's a competitive district that leans Republican, right? So if you could somehow erase everything that's happened, it seems like a really nice time to enter. And if you weren't necessarily the next person in the pecking order to run for office, maybe you think this is your time. Maybe if you're a strategic politician, you say, this is my one time to get in, that if McCready does get elected, he's going to lock up that seat for years to come, given the strength of the incumbency advantage in the U.S. Congress. So I think you jump in if you think the timing's right and it may never be here again.
In terms of that power of incumbency, is it any bit diminished as we think about a special election or a shorter incumbency? Because for whomever wins this race, let's just go ahead and say there will be a primary, a second primary, and then the general election, the general special election would be September. They turn around, whoever wins, and they're going to have to file again in 3 months to run for the 2020 election. So to what extent is there really an incumbency when you've only been there for such a short period of time?
Well, I think there is some incumbency advantage, but it's weakened, right? So if we think, why do people have incumbency advantage? Well, one reason they have it is that they, frankly, do stuff for their constituents. They get a Social Security check to show up on time. They meet with a class when somebody comes to Washington. But the other reason you get an incumbency advantage is you've got name recognition. And McCready, one thing that's come out of this is he has name recognition like few other candidates we've seen. So if he is to pull this out, I think he would be the favorite. I think he would have some incumbency advantage. It just wouldn't be as strong as if he had been in for 2 years.
All right, let's move for a moment to the 3rd Congressional District, where there is also a vacancy, a special election. We found out the schedule of it this week. The filing period is underway. There's going to be a primary on April 30th and potentially a second primary if no candidate reaches 30% of the vote. This is to fill the seat of Walter Jones, who was a 13-term congressman from this eastern Coastal Plains district. It was a district his father also served for more than two decades, and he was very much this independent libertarian type, populist type, who bucked party leadership and was very much his own man in Congress. We don't see a lot of that. As this field is starting to take form, we've got Greg Murphy, a state House representative who's a doctor from Pitt County. We've got Michael Speciale, who's a very right Republican lawmaker, but also very much supported by his constituents in Craven County. Michelle Nix, who is vice president of the state GOP. Phil Shepard, who's a House representative. So I'm just ticking off some of the more notable candidates in this. But as you look at the third and we start to get into it, who's the favorite?
Yeah, I'm not sure who the favorite is. I think kind of my takeaway at this point is, you look at the data, right? You actually look at the voting patterns, right? Jones has this reputation as having been a very moderate member of Congress. And it turns out this is a case where the conventional wisdom is exactly right. So if you look at the scores political scientists use, they're called nominate scores. They basically take all of the votes that members of Congress take and they put them on this big scale. Jones was more liberal than 97% of his Republican colleagues, right? So he was one of the last moderates in Congress. So whoever it is that takes over, if we can judge by voting patterns that they've had in the General Assembly, we're going to move from one of the most moderate members of Congress to potentially one of the more extreme members of Congress overnight. So if you're the kind of person who thinks a lot about polarization and are we getting better in polarization, are we getting worse, are we going to stop this, I think no matter what the outcome of this election is, we're going to have a more polarized Congress at the end of it than we did before.
Do you think it's more or less likely that we see someone, and I did just hear your last answer, but do you think if there are two candidates remaining, if there is a runoff and one is a little bit more moderate and emblematic of Walter Jones, if that's possible, if a candidate exists in this district, or somebody who's more extreme, you think we're going to get the latter, not the former?
I do think we're going to get the latter, not the former. And part of it is that it looks like, if you go by voting patterns in the General Assembly, of the three folks who have expressed interest, who are in the General Assembly, they're all, among the most conservative folks in our General Assembly. If you look at their Civitas score, you look at any other kind of metric of voting behavior, as you noted, these are not moderates. And so I think it's very unlikely that we're going to get a moderate out of this district unless somebody comes out of the woodwork.
All right, a couple to move through with some quickness before we get you out of here, Chris. Presidential politics, crowded Democratic field. Who has piqued your interest among the announced candidates thus far?
You know, I think Harris, Kamala Harris from California, has picked up a lot more steam than I thought she would, right? She's already been in South Carolina. She appears like the kind of candidate who would do well in this early Democratic field. And so I'd say she has piqued my interest much more than I thought she would, frankly. I think Cory Booker has done less than I thought he would. But as you pointed out, it is way early. And if there's any time I feel discouraged at political punditry, it is watching folks try to predict the outcome of a primary.
Not going to ask you to do it, despite the fact that I did ask you to do it with the congressional races. So apologies.
No. It's purely the presidential when we've got a field this big. It's just okay. It's kind of funny for me to watch.
Which candidate from the Democratic field can claim most accurately or honestly to be closest to a centrist, in your opinion?
You know, there's...
If any.
Perhaps Harris, interestingly. And it's one reason why I think Kamala Harris has got a sort of an interesting profile, right? I mean, here's somebody who obviously is an African-American and could perhaps appeal to a very large voting bloc in the Democratic Party, but at the same time has been... kind of tough on crime, really, in California. And so if you say, hey, we got an African-American candidate, female candidate from California, you might think this would be an extreme leftist candidate. And that's not what Harris is at all. So I think she might actually have an interesting claim to most moderate.
I heard you before, I swear, when you talked about the polarized nature of politics. I'm aware. I live it. I see it on a daily basis. But I am wondering if you think, just sticking with this Democratic line of questions here, if there's a place or a likelihood for a moderate to enter the race, a true moderate. And if you think these are two bad examples, please tell me. But the two I'm thinking of, one is Michael Bennett, U.S. Senator from Colorado. The other, lesser known for sure, is Steve Bullock, governor of Montana.
Yeah.
What do you think about a moderate entering this race? Is that just blasphemy in this day and age?
No, I don't think it's blasphemy at all. I think it's very possible, right? So I think, look, we're going to have a huge Democratic field. And it really appears to me that the Democrats did not learn the primary lesson from Donald Trump, which was not anything about the general. It was, hey, look, if you have 17 candidates, you're going to have a mess and who knows what could come out the back end. So I think the Democrats are doing some of the same things. But I think if they can have a moderate candidate who can distinguish themselves from everybody else in the field and somehow get their name out there, which somebody like Bullock would have a hard time doing, I think it's not blasphemy at all. I think it is possible that that could be the exact kind of candidate who could be successful. Think about a Bill Clinton.
There is a bill rolled out at the General Assembly this week that would make using a cell phone with your hands or having a wireless communications device on your body illegal. Texting while driving, already illegal in the state, but law enforcement has said that it's pretty difficult to enforce because if you pull somebody over, you saw them on their phone, you can't prove that they were texting unless they were to own up to that. And if you're on email or Snapchat or Facebook, that is legal. Question, last time you used your cell phone with your hands while driving?
Well, I was at a stoplight earlier today, and I was emailing you, and I misspelled my own name at the stoplight. So I did it this morning. I'm ashamed of it, and my punishment is that I publicly have to say I didn't even spell my own name correctly in the signature line.
And I will just point out, perhaps you're unaware, that you emailing at a stoplight is legal under present state law. You're allowed to do that.
Oh, and which is exactly why I did it. I knew it. I was fully aware.
Okay. forecasting, and this might be a throwaway question if you don't want to weigh in on it, but forecasting this particular bill at the legislature, it's early. We're going to see hundreds of more bills between now and just now and the remainder of the session. What's your feel on a bill like this? We saw a similar bill get hung up in Virginia. The Legislative Black Caucus was not in favor of it, and it died. We're seeing a similar bill move through in South Carolina right now. What kind of viability does this have at the legislature?
You know, I think it does have some viability, right? I mean, this is, you know, jokes aside, we were making a minute ago. I mean, it is a serious public health issue, and I think it's the kind of thing that can be bipartisan. Georgia, if I understand correctly, has just passed a very similar law. It strikes me as the kind of thing that's going to become law in all states eventually. So, I think it's got it definitely has a decent chance. It's not an immediately polarizing issue. You know, if I ask the listener, hey, is this a liberal or conservative issue, I think it'd be hard to really give a good answer on that. So, certainly I think it's got a chance.
One political story that the media is not presently paying enough attention to.
Well, You know, I think the general, actually, I think this bill introduced, I believe, yesterday or the day before, that would sort of set some limits on our terms in North Carolina is really potentially interesting, right? We've got this strange situation here where our state legislators are paid $13,951 a year, all right? So not exactly a huge sum of money. We have supposedly a short session and a long session, but there's no law that says that the short session actually has to be shorter than the long session. And so for candidate recruitment, getting folks to run for office, particularly way out west, we're saying, hey, make $14,000 a year, show up for some amount of days, but we're really not going to tell you how many days. And so putting some harder limits on how long the legislature can be in session, the General Assembly can be in session, could actually get us some different types of candidates, again, particularly as we get farther from Raleigh. So I think that's a particularly important issue. We've seen some bills in the past to raise the pay of state legislators. That never goes very far. And so if we're not going to do that, I think this is maybe a smart way to think about reform of our institution.
Chris Cooper teaches political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University. He is the department head out there. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Cooper, Cooper with a C, Chris Cooper, WCU. Chris, thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Yeah, it was great fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, as always, for tuning in. You can download the program wherever it is that you get that on-demand listening and stay up to date with whatever is happening at your legislature and on Capitol Hill. That's at our website, wunc.org. For Chris Cooper, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend.